I have no notes.
Perfect.
What's the movie? Kids.
Yeah, Kids.
1997. We might be childhood friends, and I might drive you around the bend, but I'm sure it's crazy kids to work it out in the end. I might kiss you on the lips despite your nose, but I guess that's how it goes. Let's keep falling in love with our strange bedfellows.
Hello and welcome to the big show. It's Strange Bedfellows. I am Daddy Jack.
I am... we're saying daddies now?
You can, if you are a daddy.
Oh, okay. I am Daddy Tanner.
And we are joined by a guest this week, the great, do you want to be a daddy, honorary daddy, Matthew, or?
I think I'm an uncle for this.
Okay. We're joined by the great uncle, Matthew Perpetua, music writer and creator of the great Flux blog and Flux Pod music podcast and blog that everybody should listen to. And
oh, any notable episodes, Jack?
Any notable episodes of FluxPod?
Yeah, what would you say is a good place to start for the podcast?
There's so many different points to dive into, but if you truly love music, you should listen to the episode. I assume you've only done one, all about REM, in which special guest Jack Shepherd talks with Matthew for 2 hours.
Yeah, it was a long one. We went REM, real deep.
And it's a great episode.
I guess my invite to come on and talk about something corporate.
Cherry Pop and Daddies. Okay, there we go.
I'm going to start recording episodes again soon, so it might be time. It might be time.
This week,
welcome to the show, Matthew.
We are talking about Singles. Tanner, had you ever seen it before?
No.
I assume you've seen it before, Matthew. I assume it's a touchstone for you, but maybe not.
Yeah, I saw it a bunch of times when I was a teenager, and then I think in 10-year intervals since. So, I think watching it now is like, okay, this is the first time I think I've watched it since I'm definitively older than everyone in it.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, frightened me when Bridget Fonda said that she was, I think, 22 years old.
23. But I mean, I think some of the older characters, like the Kira Sedgwick character, I think she's meant to be around 30, 31, something like that.
I don't know how to relate to a 23-year-old. This movie can't ask me to, especially a 23-year-old from Seattle in 1992. It seemed like an entirely different ecosystem.
Yeah. I mean, that's also you saying you can't relate to a person who's significantly older than you.
Oh, I know. Yeah, no, I sent Jack a text last night and said, this movie is full of some of the best hits that my dad loves that I've ever heard. Because when this movie came out in 1992, I was 8 and my parents were in their 30s.
Okay. So that actually was true. I thought you were just making fun of me.
No.
Which is why I didn't respond. I was like, okay, all right, calm down. But in fact, that's literally true.
Yeah. I know several adult people who were born at the same time or just after this movie coming out. Which is a whole thing. People who are currently 30 years old.
And yeah.
They were not here yet for this movie.
Horrifying.
Time. It's just crazy.
We have a segment which we'll maybe do in the second half of this episode where I pull a bunch of Rotten Tomatoes reviews of the film and we talk about them and do a little light role play.
Yeah, some role play. It's mostly me.
Tanner does a little light role play. I role play as myself. And I was looking, I spent a long time looking for, I wanted to get the perfect funny review of someone who was 20 and just watched it as a movie and didn't get who are all these dudes with long hair and what's this music? But there wasn't that because I guess this movie doesn't register for those people. They don't know about it.
I mean, the movie had the good fortune of hitting at the exact moment that Pearl Jam blew up. So everyone in it would be...
Well, maybe because of this movie.
Where's the chicken and where's the egg?
It
was a little bit after it because, I mean, it certainly helped. But, that Pearl Jam record was out for maybe up to a year before there. And Soundgarden had been around a bit. Alice in Chains had been around a bit. But they weren't famous the way they were famous the time this came out.
Yeah. So this will be my first of many pieces of trivia I'm going to share about this film. Oh. I did a real deep dive. I read a bunch of articles and retrospectives.
Let me ease myself in here. Let me get comfortable.
So they made the movie, if Cameron Crowe is to be believed. before Nevermind. So the movie was made like basically like a bunch of like, you know, like Chris Cornell was working in a coffee shop and they made the movie, and Warner Brothers had decided they weren't going to put the movie out because they didn't get it. And then Nevermind hit and Warner Brothers was like, please, can we release this immediately and call it Come As You Are?
Even though Nirvana is the one band who has nothing
to do with this, literally not on it.
The soundtrack. There's no reference point to them at all. It's like even the sub pop stuff is about Mudhoney and not them.
Yeah, one of the guys, can't remember if it's Matt Dillon, is wearing like a Green River t-shirt. Like the Mother Love Bone is the, you know, the beating heart of this movie, not Nirvana. But they made it work. Apparently, then Warner Brothers came back to Cameron Crowe and was like, okay, cool, we've got another title. Can we call it One Hot Summer? It's like, what is wrong with you? And then he was like, the quote is, he said, no, it's not called One Hot Summer, it's called Singles. And then finally, I think their kids were telling them, you have Pearl Jam in this movie, you have to put it out.
Yeah, it's funny because there's a version of history where Pearl Jam did not blow up in any way, and like, oh yeah, you know those guys who were in Pearl Jam, like they were you know, they had that record. Like it would be kind of similar if, like, I don't know, if like now I'm just losing some kind of good analogy for this, but yeah, it's like you know, they would just be like nobodies at the time of this. They would just be like guys who were like used to be in a band and their friend.
Yeah, totally.
Eddie Vedder would be their new friend.
Yeah, it's like it's the two of the members of Mother Love Bone and like the guy who's sleeping on their couch.
Yeah. Just our friend from San Diego, Ed.
Tanner, should we describe this film? Would you like to describe this film since you're kind of a virgin receiver of this film? Sorry I said it that way. I wish I hadn't. It's out now.
I'll describe the film as a virgin receiver to the best of my abilities. I assume that you both love this film. And any sort of like interference with that would be... great offense.
I would be like tremendously offended, but yeah.
Yeah, I love the movie like maybe more having I've watched it like five times. I watched it certainly when it came out and remember thinking that they were a lot cooler than I do now watching them. But that's a thing about being older and relating to young people.
And also like this is what being an adult
is
like.
Totally.
All right. I got it.
So you just tread carefully.
My descriptions. Yeah. Okay. All right, so there's this like human penis, this like nothing of a man, who's sort of the main character of the movie, and his name is Steve, and he just has no defining qualities. He wasn't in a movie before this movie, and he hasn't ever been in a movie again after this movie. So he is kind of the guy we follow. He works for like the Department of Transportation and is proposing this preposterous plan to run like a Snowpiercer train. Yeah.
And it's pointed out, this is before the monorail episode of the season.
This is what I've been working on. If you had a train, right, a super train, you give the people a good reason to get out of their cars, you give them great coffee, great music, they will park and ride. I know they will.
I still love my car, though.
It's a bad plan.
It's ridiculous. And everyone up until the sensible mayor...
Yeah.
It's like, wow, this is going to like solve all the world's problems. and his plan is to have like a Hyperloop train. He's like Elon before his time.
Yeah. You don't get to do that when you're just a guy working at the Department of Transportation. Like if your pet idea will require an entire like infrastructure bill out of Congress, like work on something else.
But everyone encouraged him along up until the mayor just like politely declines and like sends him on his way. Yeah. Of course.
This is the Campbell Scott character.
Yeah. Campbell Scott is the actor. Yeah. I think he's famous now. I think he's in like Billions or something.
He's a working actor. He's got one of those faces that's easy to forget.
And then Pearl Jam comes and they like do a set.
Okay. But it's Pearl Jam. It's Citizen Dick.
Citizen Dick comes and they like do a set.
Eddie Vedder's the drummer.
This guy, Steve, likes Seattle 90s grunge music a lot.
Yeah, it's just the local music.
It's just the local coffee
shop. The
bands
who happen to be in town.
Yeah. He wouldn't categorize
it. It's sort of the version, though, of 90s grunge music that went on to become like that one time Nickelback sang about Spider-Man, you know?
Yes. Okay, yes.
Yeah, it's the origin point for that family of rock music.
Yes.
But, you know, it's funny, you can think about it, if Seattle was just more of a ska town, like, this whole movie is just, like, them going to ska shows.
Imagine that, like, the dystopian, like, Philip K. Dick future, where Seattle was a ska town instead of a grunge town. Country music would sound totally different right now, I think.
Mm-hmm. They'd be doing like some kind of ska voice.
The fact that this movie was made kind of before grunge blew up is such an interesting, like, trapped in amber way that this film projects itself, because it is unsure of itself. Like, Paula Abdul was apparently supposed to play, was even did like screen tests. I would love to see them. Was supposed to play the part of the girl who like does the video dating.
This is just profoundly lucky because like Cameron Crowe just happened to be living in the Pacific Northwest at the time. And, you know, his background is as a music journalist. He worked for Rolling Stone. Obviously he made Almost Famous, which is kind of about him being like a teenage Rolling Stone writer. But like his instincts of, oh, there's a cool scene going on right now. Like maybe that'd be a good backdrop for a rom-com.
Yeah, totally.
You know, like no one else would be thinking that.
Where's Cameron Crowe's Juggalo?
We should have a Juggalo rom-com. That'd be amazing.
That could have been you, Tanner.
You should have had one in like
2005. That should have been you.
It's a little past the window, but you know, they still have The Gathering every year.
Weren't you doing a film degree in like Colorado around the time that like ICP was first on the scene?
It's just, yeah, man. Yeah, I was part of that
sliding doors moment.
I remember one day in high school, my junior year of high school, I was hanging out with this real buster of a dude.
Okay.
who at one point we went out to lunch. He like drove me to lunch every day. Like we would just get lunch around school. And he drove me to lunch, and instead of going to lunch, he made me go to Best Buy to get in line to wait for a double release of an ICP album that was like, you got two different versions of the same album, and they had different clowns on the cover.
Wow, real innovators.
And we didn't get to eat lunch that day.
Wait, so is it like the Shania Twain record where half of it is like the country version, the other half is the pop version?
I imagine so, yeah. One half's like murder rock, and the other is like... murder death hip hop.
Or
yeah,
is it maybe like the Flaming Lips record where they released like four different records that you have to play at the same time?
You know what? I'm gonna admit to you guys, we likely listened to it on the way back to school.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure I've heard the album since.
Put them on simultaneously and tell us if you discover anything about yourself.
I won't do that. this movie, it's weird that it's like right at the cutting edge of the grunge movement because it seems like such a funny parody of it. Like Matt Dillon's character is like he looks like a Portlandia sketch.
But I was thinking about this too. It's like if you were to make a movie like even 1 year after this and you're like, okay, we need a character that's kind of making fun of this Eddie Vedder guy. And like that's what you would have come up with.
Yeah.
But then you have like this guy and he's literally in scenes with Eddie Vedder and it's played like, oh, this is my friend.
Fun fact, if I may share some trivia with you, Chris Cornell was originally going to play that part of Soundgarden. And Matt Dillon came in at the last minute and took the part. I think Cameron Crowe said...
Oh, as a movie star.
Yeah, well, I think Cameron Crowe said that it was like... he was like obsessed with Soundgarden and he couldn't make it happen because like they... Soundgarden had too many shows to play to like be a
Chris Cornell's in this movie and he doesn't have a lot of screen presence.
But
you get a lot of naked chest from him.
Matt Dillon is also wearing, I think, either Jeff Ament or Stone Gossard's wardrobe. Like all of his outfits in the movie were just like borrowed literally from Jeff Ament's wardrobe.
That makes sense. And he does wear like a dumb hat at some point, so it must have been Jeff Ament. Yeah,
that's right. Oh wait, is it Jeff who wears the dumb hat and not Stone?
They both wear dumb hats. But Jeff wears the dumber hats.
Okay. Yeah. There we go. Fair enough.
Yeah. Pearl Jam's a major like dumb hat band.
They're a big... people right. forget that about Pearl Jam. They were a major dumb hat band.
We have to stop talking about the bad guys from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. We have to get back to this movie and the plot. So that guy is friends with everyone in his apartment complex, which has a big sign up front that says singles.
Yeah. Because it's like single rooms.
They're single units.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. Very cool.
So we get to know everyone in the apartment complex. There's one woman that they all make fun of and like mercilessly gaslight.
Yeah.
Just for their own amusement. Yeah. And we just sort of like, she's sort of like the Scrat the Rat like thing in Ice Age who's always chasing that nut. You know, just sort of this like fun little like interstitial where we get to laugh at this woman's misfortune.
Right. And how would you describe her? I would say like she's kind of like the person who's like real MTV.
She's
like what she's meant to be in the moment.
I think she's like a yuppie. Like she's just sort of like.
Yeah, but the Campbell Scott and Kira Sedgwick characters are like, those are just fully yuppie people.
Yeah.
But you're supposed to look at them as, oh, they're normal. So like, I think she is kind of supposed to kind of be taken as kind of like, what maybe today you'd have her be like someone who is like trying to be an influencer or something. Like that would be that character.
She's definitely got that energy. She's up for anything.
Yeah. She just couldn't influence. There was no way to do it.
And then also Kira Sedgwick, the closer, lives here. She's not the closer yet. She's like still a child.
Yeah.
But she's like she's working. She's like, I don't remember what she does. Presumably something that ends with her illustrious career as the closer.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like some junior DA.
And Bridget Fonda's in it.
Yeah. She just works at the coffee shop.
Yeah, she works at the coffee shop, and she dates Matt Dillon, who plays for Citizen Dick, who's mostly just Pearl Jam and Matt Dillon.
Well, they're also kind of mudhoney, because like the main joke of them is like a parody of Touch Me, I'm Sick.
Right.
Of course, sure.
And there are some epic performances. Like they go to...
They really make you sit through them, huh?
They do have like a meet cute during a Alice in Chains performance of Wood.
Yeah.
And they're like,
yeah. I watched this earlier today and one of the parts that made me laugh was like, you know, there's the joke where it's like, we'll always go dancing. And they're just dancing to like Alice in Chains, which just feels like, that's how you go dancing? That's just like this kind of like sludgy, like heroin music. Okay.
Yeah, I also think Alice in Chains, like before grunge really blew up, Alice in Chains must have read as like way more metal and way more dark.
Yeah, I think initially they were kind of like trying to get in on hair metal a little bit. I think they're kind of like a weird liminal band because like they're kind of the Jane's Addiction and them are kind of like this kind of like bridge between like regular metal and kind of what would become grunge.
And like some glam vibes.
Yeah. And like and Soundgarden too, but I think more of those two because there is that glam element. Like you could kind of see how a Guns N' Roses person like, yeah, this rocks.
Have we said the plot of the film?
Paul Giamatti's in the movie.
That's true. There's some crazy cameos.
Jeremy Piven. As a nearly balding guy. And that changed.
President America from Independence Day. Is a love interest.
He's got like a, you think he's going to like have a little bit of a part, but then they just whisk him away, shoo him away.
I guess he's like a corporate stooge. So there is like, I want to get into this.
He's a doctor.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, fine. He's like a rich, successful man.
I should keep describing the plot.
Yes.
Bridget Fonda's whole thing is that she's in love with Eddie Vedder and he doesn't care about her that much. So she goes to all these like great lengths to please him and decides to get breast augmentation surgery and meets the president from Independence Day.
Yeah. And by Eddie Vedder, you mean Matt Dillon.
Matt Dillon.
Yeah. We got to keep it straight in the seat. Because
Eddie Vedder is in the film.
Yeah. And then he convinces her not to get the surgery. Because he's in love with her.
Which is a weird move.
Having met
her once. I feel like you should reflect on what your chosen profession is. Because it's a very 90s, like breast augmentation surgery is bad, is the implication.
But we're all doing it.
Right. And he's also like 32. Like they say he's either 32 or 33. And he's just like, there's a whole thing where like she's just giving him like life advice. Like, hey, man, maybe you should just change your hair. It's like... It's a real interesting scene because like what I think in other periods of time may have been like, okay, this is fucked up and weird and like some boundaries are crossed. It's like, you know, there's a moment of acknowledging that immediately goes to, oh, no, actually, no, you're sweet.
Yeah. There's a different telling of this story that's like the manic pixie dream girl and this considerably older man. Speaking of, Victor Garber's in the movie too.
Okay.
While we're going through the dramatis personae.
Eric Stoltz plays a mime.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Did we say Tim Burton? He's in it.
Tim Burton
plays
has
a creepy director.
Cameo as a director of a video dating video.
I will create your new look. I will have men dying at your feet. $10 extra. And Brian will shoot your video.
20.
He doesn't even know me.
Debbie, he is only like the next Martin Scorsese.
Yeah. The guy who started Sub Pop is one of the guys in the video dating, the Bruce Pavitt.
Oh, really? Yeah. I missed that. That's really fun.
Yeah, it's one of the pretty like costly and dangerous pranks that they pull on the poor red-haired lady is getting her signed up for video dating.
It kind of works. She entraps a handsome biker, but
right. But that goes wrong. Like everything is just like humiliating to her, and then she just kind of goes away, and you just don't see her anymore.
Like, yeah,
but it's like I don't know. I guess that's a person in life. It's the person who's just like constantly humiliated, and nothing really works for them. And then like, oh wait, whatever happened to her? Oh, don't worry about it.
Yeah, she moved. Yeah. Basically, it's an ensemble. It's about a bunch of friends hanging out in coffee shops in Seattle. Now I would like to reveal to you my second interesting piece of trivia.
Good. Thank God.
You can sit back in the cut, Tanner. You don't have to take your headphones all the way off, but yeah. After the success of this film, which, you know, it's a good movie, but I think it really hit at exactly the right time to take advantage of like the explosion of grunge. And after the success, there was a lot of interest in doing a sitcom, a singles sitcom. And Cameron Crowe was like, absolutely no, fuck you. So they took the idea, modified it a little bit, changed the city, and called it.
Shut up. It's going to be called Friends. Yeah, Friends. Right. You can't like, I bet you can find some way to like make any movie or TV show or book from the 80s.
Hey, I'm just the messenger. I'm just the messenger of this fact.
Friends.
Well, it's funny that I didn't know that, but that makes so much sense. But also, like, in watching this now, it really just felt like speed running a season of a TV show because there is no like real plot.
Yeah, totally.
But you are just watching like this gang of like 20 something people trying to date.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know, and that's just very like a TV show. You could have kept this going. There's no real end point to this movie. It just kind of stops.
It's very Melrose Place.
Yes. It's very Melrose.
It even has
Place.
This sort of courtyard,
right? Yeah,
or Chuck, if you guys are familiar with NBC's Chuck. Of course, which also featured sort of a, you know, social hangout area.
Isn't he like a superhero?
Apartments. Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah. So yeah. You're familiar. You've seen the show. Yeah.
He's a superhero.
He gets like the CIA
the
database
Geek Squad.
Downloaded into his brain.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. And he works for the Geek Squad.
That's a great reference point. Thank you, Tanner.
Definitely an evolution of this movie.
I want to talk about two things in some depth before our break. The first is, I guess, just the 90s-ness of this. Like, my big thought...
Absurd. Absurdly 90s.
It's absurdly 90s, but it's also, like, literally the beginning of the
90s. Yeah,
it's literally before grunge hits, so they don't... I was thinking about this in relation to Reality Bites, which Tanner and I have also talked about on a previous podcast. Reality Bites comes out in 1994. So by that point, like, the tone... And the vocabulary of the 90s has already been set. And they're
it's like MTV-atized by then.
Yeah.
This feels much fresher.
Well, and the MTV-atizing of it is like a big part of the subject matter of the Reality Bites. And like it's people are like pushing back against it. They're like, we are becoming commodities and like our authenticity is in question because it's being commoditized by MTV.
Yeah, right. Simpsons. The whole dramatic end in that movie is like about selling out. Whereas this movie, like, no one even has the option of selling out. The idea that, like, any of this grunge stuff could be popular is, like, laughable, which is, you know, funny in how it actually turned out and how the movie was actually, you know, came out once all that stuff had been, like, massively successful.
But it's still, you can still see the germs of, like, that, like, obsession with cool and authenticity and what it means. There's a scene at the 18-minute mark where Linda, I think is her name, is being hit on by what's his name? I can't remember his name.
Great.
What did you call him?
Why do we even do the dramatic persona at the beginning of every episode?
Steve. Campbell Scott character.
By Campbell Scott. And he comes up and he's like,
my friend and I have this long-running argument, and here it is. He says that when you come to a place like this, you can't just be yourself. You have to have an act. So anyway, I saw you standing there. So I thought, A, I could just leave you alone. B, I could come up with an act. Or C, I could just be myself. I chose C. What do you think?
And she said, she responds,
I think that A, you have an act. Uh-huh. And that B, not having an act is your act.
And that's like, that's like so oh,
first listicle.
Fucking 90s. Yeah, it's the first yeah. listicle.
But also
since the Ten Commandments.
But you know, the part I had, there's parts of this movie that I had just completely forgotten. They're just gone from my mind, even despite having seen it a few times. And the first was like the beginning of that movie where like she is being taken in by this guy who has an act, and it's a whole, and she kind of catches him in it. He's like, you know, he's from Spain and he has to go and
like, oh yeah.
You know,
it's like this whole vignette. It's like the first 10 minutes of the movie.
It's yeah. really funny. Yeah.
I want you to have this. I wish I was better able to tell you what I'm thinking. But this is a symbol of our future. I want to return in 2 months and see you again.
There's a lot of stuff in this movie that because it's about dating, and because it, you know, aside from the sequence of the video dating, which you know is just a joke in the context of the movie, where it's like, oh, this is like really just like another universe of how people dated. This is like the IRL, everything is IRL. You have to go places, you have to meet people.
Oh, I know, horrifying.
Yeah. So, like, I feel like this is one of those movies that would just be like, if you showed this to a person who is like currently like 21, 22, they would just be like, what is this? Like, you know, they would understand that like the past 40s. Existed, but it would still just be very much harder to relate to all these people who have to constantly like go up to someone at a bar.
It may as well be about like a Sadie Hawkins dance, you know, like it's just so old fashioned. What are the other plot lines in the apartment building?
That's most of it.
Yeah. Well, there's also like the Campbell Scott character is friends with the Bridget Fonda character platonically.
Yes, although he's like a creep to everyone. But he does fall in love with the closer.
Yes.
He falls in love with the closer. She
who also lives in the apartment complex.
Doesn't want him. I can't totally remember why. She thinks it's not going to work. And then there's a miscarriage scene. Mm-hmm. Where she becomes pregnant, and then there's sort of a lot of questions about whether or not she's ready to be a mom, and then they're in a car wreck, which is kind of a surprising end to the film. But everyone is okay, and they do get together, and that's the end of that.
It's sort of implied that he caused it to happen.
He did a bad driving.
Well, he kind of has this, like, as a city planner yeah. and, like, as a highway, like, man, he sort of has this, like, sixth sense for, okay. like, infrastructure failure, and right before the car accident he's right. like, oh, this yellow light is lasting too long, and then like proceeds yeah. to go through it.
So you think this movie is just like a subtle attempt to get an infrastructure bill passed in Seattle?
Yeah, every single thing about it is that he has an agenda. Everything is just a need to the end of we must get this train.
Whatever the cost.
He's like this diabolical Ayn Rand character, and there is a point in the movie where like Bridget Fonda's
I clocked it too.
Yeah, she's like hanging out on her roof, and she's got was it the Fountainhead? I think it was the Fountainhead.
It's the Fountainhead, and it's right after her breakup scene. And it's funny, the fountain. So she's like, you know, she's like free from this douchey Eddie Vedder type, and she's shown like sunbathing and in a carefree manner, browsing the Fountainhead, and it just hits so different. I think that's another just like of the time. Like now it would be such a signifier.
Yeah.
Of
oh, yeah. Like, be a parody character.
But at the time, I think it reads as like she's cultured and also like ready to be free.
I think even more than that, it just looks like a book that she may have just found on the street.
Yeah.
I think that above all else is what it is. Like, oh, what's this about?
Another thing that hits really different, I think it's Linda. Kyra Sedgwick, at the 29-minute mark, she says,
well, I thought for sure I'd meet someone in college, you know? A perfect combination of Mel Gibson and Holden Caulfield and the sexual revolution would just sweep us both away.
Oh, what a dream.
Oh, right, and then really... there's the scene where she's, like, at the in college, and she's at, like, a party where everyone has to dress as their favorite contraception. And I thought that was interesting because like it's a kind of a weird cultural inflection point that doesn't really get remarked on, is that there is this point in the 80s once like AIDS really kicks in where like so much culture on the stuff
yeah.
like, changes drastically.
And it was also like old, like that one point during the right before the miscarriage scene, sorry to bring that specter back, they decide to go and do a bunch of pregnancy tests, and they're all like medieval. Like, you're like mixing like vials of potions together to figure out if you're pregnant. So,
and Jeremy Piven is the grocery store clerk.
Yeah, he's good. Plays a very Pivian.
Yeah, I like the
Piven character.
Moment where, you know, he's just goofing around, but then he sees things like, oh, or maybe you might be busy.
Yeah, we got two bad. It's going to be insane. Would you get up and do a little Wheels of Steel?
No.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
You're the only man I know who can mix up Elvis Costello and Public Enemy. What's so funny about peace, love and under, peace, death row, what does a brother understand, peace, peace, understand, peace, you're the best, man, you are the king, you gotta be there, man, you must be there. Of course, you may be busy.
Yeah.
Can we talk about the soundtrack to this film? Because in many ways, as a lot of Rotten Tomatoes reviewers pointed out, this is more soundtrack than movie.
It's kind of a standard rom-com that just happens to have like this incredible soundtrack that has, I would say, at least four or five like stone classic songs on it.
Do you want to play a game that I didn't invent it, but I like to play, which is, let's guess what is the most streamed on Spotify song on this soundtrack. In fact, can you name the top five?
I mean, I probably in the top five. I'm guessing the number one, it might be Wood or it might be Drown.
So Drown is disqualified because it's not streaming.
Oh, okay. It wouldn't be streaming as part of that. It would be streaming separately as part of like,
right,
the Pumpkins catalog. So I'm guessing it would be Alice in Chains' Wood.
It's Wood, yeah, by
yeah.
a long shot.
Yeah.
So Wood has like at 200, more than 200 million streams, and the second biggest song on the soundtrack is
State of Love and Trust.
State of Love and Trust by Pearl Jam is number three. Number two, of course,
the Chris Cornell is song,
Nearly Lost You by Screaming Trees.
Oh, interesting. I would have guessed Breath and State of Love and Trust. The two Pearl Jam songs would be ahead of that. But you know what? I think there might be like a lot of vote splitting in terms of that because
those appear on comps and
right, exactly. I think like the versions of Breath and State of Love and Trust that probably get more are on the actual like Pearl Jam greatest hits thing.
Well, and a lot of these songs because of like
it's a
when
Swedish company too.
When this
Spotify.
Okay, perfect. Yeah, thank you, Tanner.
So it's going to skew.
Yeah.
Like Northern European.
To what Swedish people are interested in.
Yeah.
That's a good understanding of Spotify. A lot of these songs are like non-album tracks because, you know, these bands were just like, we're not famous. And Drown is kind of a famous example of that. It's, I think probably, Matthew, you're the real Smashing Pumpkins expert here, but I probably one of their best songs.
Excuse me?
I would say it's one of the best. But it definitely was like a big moment for them because it was probably like the first real exposure they had. And then I think within a year, Siamese Dream came out.
Oh, people heard Billy Corgan's beautiful vocals in this movie and they're like, oh, I want more of that.
One of the reasons I think that this is not streaming on the single soundtrack on Spotify is that Billy Corgan has this like real anger about the way Drown was treated for
right,
singles.
Right, because it was meant to be a single, but then I guess they decided not to.
It was blowing up on the radio. They gave it to singles instead of putting it on Siamese Dream. And they feel that the record label Epic, I think, killed it because Wood by Alice in Chains was taking off so dramatically
right. And
that
also
they didn't want
a
Drown
too.
To like interfere with that.
Because the Pumpkins were signed to Virgin, and I believe Alice in Chains was in the Epic Sony group. So it was like they had a vested interest in promoting Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains.
But yeah, so Drown, I think, was their like probably first really big exposure after, I guess, what, Rhinoceros or whatever?
Yeah, like, and that would be like pretty minor. Right. So yeah, this would be like the first like Pumpkin song that would conceivably be played on normal radio and even just kind of in a smaller capacity. They didn't really get like serious airplay until like a year later when Today was big.
But I think if it had been on Siamese Dream, it would have been second or third single and would have been just like vastly bigger than it is yeah. in the like cultural consciousness.
I mean, it's from the Gish era. So I think it was pretty much recorded in the can before they started.
Because they're literally, now you're literally talking nonsense. You're just making up words just to see if I'm paying attention. Oh, the Gish era. You didn't think I'd catch that one.
The first record is called Gish.
It feels totally Siamese Dream to me, though.
Yeah. It's kind of like the beginning of that whole phase. And it's a classic song. They play it live a lot to this day.
We won't do the whole soundtrack, Tanner, I promise.
But, yeah, Green Day's on it, and
Something Corporate.
Wheatus. Yeah. Something Corporate and Jack's Mannequin, both.
The biggest song on this at the time and now is Wood by Alice in Chains.
Yeah, one of the definitive Alice in Chains songs.
It's a fucking banger. I had never put together, this is like so obvious, but I think it's a tribute to Andrew Wood, who, the singer of Mother Love Bone.
Yeah, and not the put title together at least.
The title, because it's Wood, W-O-L-D, question mark.
Wood?
I am kind of a big Alice in Chains fan, which is funny. I really like them. I certainly like Dirt era Alice in Chains. And I am obsessed with Lane Staley and Jerry Cantrell's harmonies.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things that really sets them apart, is that they're like this metal band that has like this kind of like weird kind of medieval harmony vocal.
They're gorgeous.
Yeah, it's very distinctive.
I've spent a weird amount of time looking at YouTube videos by musicians, like picking apart like what it is about those harmonies. Apparently it is that they do, especially in like the verse part of Wood, they do a lot of parallel fourths and fifths. And the main thing, like, which, whatever, like, I'm not musical enough to even deeply understand what that means, but it's parallel. So they're, like, moving together in the same sequence, and it creates this kind of, like, eeriness.
Jesus.
I think particular to Wood, it's also just a very interesting song structure, because, you know, Jerry Cantrell's singing most of the verses, but then it kicks into the Lane Staley part. So it's like Lane Staley is almost like this kind of like you're hitting a distortion pedal to make the song go bigger.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's interesting, because like I think most people would kind of identify Lane Staley as like, oh, that's the singer from Alice in Chains, you know, R.I.P. But yeah, I mean, most of those songs, Jerry Cantrell sings like a significant chunk of the lead part.
Yeah, and then Lane Staley is doing all these, like, if you just like isolate his harmonies, they're like super funky. I think this is like an example of how, like, it's early 90s and they don't know what the 90s is going to be, and they don't know what grunge is going to be. The other like big song on this is Dyslexic Heart by Paul Westerberg.
Yeah, that's and a great song.
Totally, like, it's an awesome song. I think it's Paul Westerberg's like first going solo after The Replacements, or certainly early on.
Yeah.
He's probably like the biggest name.
Song outside of The Replacements by far.
Yeah. He's the big name that they get for this movie, and the song feels like the theme of the movie.
It's the one song that's really tied to like a rom-com energy.
But it's totally different from everything else on the soundtrack.
Like, the lyrics are overtly rom-com-y. Like, the, you know, has it, na-na-na-na. I mean, yeah, you can kind of see like the origin of Friends there too. Like, we need a song that's kind of like Dyslexic Heart, but like way more goofy.
Yeah, it totally sounds like the Rembrandts. No offense to Paul Westerberg. It's a great song. And I also noticed that this time around, Radio Song is on this, but it's not in the soundtrack.
Yeah, there's a bunch of things that aren't actually used. There's, you know, there's a... I mean, is that... Because I know they did like a huge reissue of the soundtrack. Did they end up putting it on that or no?
I'm not sure if Radio Song's on the reissue. I know that there's a Jane's Addiction song that is in that's like prominent in the movie, but it's not on the soundtrack, but maybe on the reissue.
Yeah.
And then there's like State of Love and Trust is this Pearl Jam song that's also a non-album track.
Yeah, that and Breath, those are both like 10... Those are big like 10-era songs that I guess they were like, okay, you know, we're going to use them for something else, and that's what it was for. But yeah, I mean, those are as big as anything else from that period for them. Breath happens to be one of the Pearl Jam songs I like the most.
Oh, really?
Yeah, State of Love and Trust is fine, but like I like Breath a lot. That one. There's a thing about Pearl Jam that I like, and I think it's a bit in the Chili Peppers era too, where like there is a real jock energy. They're like athletic guys. They're like into basketball and doing stuff like that. And I feel like it comes through in songs like that. There is this kind of like basketball energy.
Oh, and the song they did for the Jock Jam soundtrack.
Yeah.
Did they, like, Tanner?
Dun, 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 that one?
I don't think that's Pearl Jam.
Oh, yeah.
The, like, that's title.
That's
song
a song by
Jock
the legendary
Jam?
Sex Criminal.
close though. So I love, I hope that Eddie Vedder listens to this podcast and hears you describe Pearl Jam as both basketball energy and big hat energy.
Well, I mean, Eddie Vedder also brings surfer energy. He's a surfer guy, yeah, and like totally. Lots of the songs are literally about surfing. So, yeah, the other guys are bringing basketball energy. Jeff Amon's a basketball player. He was like, I think he was a college basketball guy. And Eddie Vedder is a surf guy. So, you know, they're bringing different kinds of jock energy to rock and roll.
Suppose we should say it's notable,
yeah,
just to get back to the movie for a moment,
sure,
that Steve, the human penis, thinks about a supersonic player named Xavier
McDaniel.
Yeah, he's in the movie. Yeah. Yeah.
McDaniel.
Steve, don't come yet.
What are you thinking right now?
Yeah, I just go out and just play basketball, good hard-nosed basketball. Things happen throughout the course of the game. It's nothing you can do. I don't go out to look to say I'm going to beat this guy up or beat that guy up.
Anything else, X?
Yes. Steve, don't come yet.
It's a very funny cameo in the movie.
Like, I would love to, like, get the pitch for that. Hey, like, Xavier, like, we want you to be in this movie, and this is your one line of dialogue.
It's iconic.
Yeah.
I'll tell you another piece of trivia, and then we can do our hit segment.
Okay.
I was going to say that State of Love and Trust was written for this movie. Apparently, it was written, Eddie Vedder, like, watched the movie and wrote the song based on watching the movie.
Oh, wow, so he was reaching for the rom-com energy. That makes sense in the lyrics, for sure. Yeah.
And the other fun trivia is that... So Jeff Ament wrote like a set list of fake Citizen Dick. Citizen Dick is the fake band fronted by Matt Dillon in the movie. So Jeff Ament wrote a set list of fake songs for them to play. And Chris Cornell like had a challenge for himself that he would like take those fake song titles and write real songs. One of which was Spoon Man.
Nice.
That's a fun
Big
fact.
Big hit for him.
Feel the rhythm while you can. Let's take a very quick break and come back with our hit segment. Everybody, it's Jack again with a brand new update about the delightful family mystery mobile game June's Journey. I have been making real progress solving puzzles and getting stuff to put on my cool estate in the fun world of mystery, danger, and romance that's conjured up by June's Journey, a game set in the roaring 20s about a daring young woman named June who's traveling to her sister's estate to uncover scandalous family secrets and customizing her own luxurious estate island in the process. Tanner, unfortunately, is still pretty convinced by the ad brief we were sent that he has actually been assigned on a real secret mission to uncover the killer of June's sister, Claire. The good news is that after some extremely frustrating conversations with the unbelievably patient people at the Central Connecticut Steamship Authority, I was able to clear up the fracas regarding the steamship that Tanner rented. But the bad news is that, if I'm reading this hastily scrawled missive correctly, he appears to have gotten himself horribly lost in a hedge maze in Würzburg, which I think is in Germany. According to the secret code on the back of the letter, which, to be clear, he's just written this part upside down, he is in good spirits and he is hot on the tail of Grandma Heath, and I shouldn't worry, but could I please send him 40 ducats in an unmarked envelope so that he can bribe the butler, which sounds both complicated and questionably legal. I'm going to keep you guys posted on this, but in the meantime, you can discover your inner detective just like I have when you download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. I have to go. There is apparently a carrier pigeon at the door with a new message from Tanner.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price.
Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And we're back. And Tanner, I'm going to let you take a break and think about what you've done for a little bit. And we're going to bring in a special friend.
I was already so far back in the cut that you calling me back to presence on the podcast, like, you could have just let me stay.
Nope, you got to go. We need Arbiter Tanner.
I don't want to go. Matthew, I should explain. Every week, Jack sends me to sort of like, have you seen the movie Priest?
No, I don't think so.
Demolition Man.
Like,
have you seen the movie?
Okay, yeah. And it was like Paul Bettany, and he sort of plays this futuristic priest. I'm pretty sure it's based on some, like,
superhero priest. You know, yeah.
Yeah, he plays a superhero priest in a dystopian future where
vampires.
There's mega cities in the desert, and there's vampires out in the desert.
Great
so
movie.
I'm sent to a futuristic version of the world that's like that, and a little bit of like mega cities from Judge Dredd too, and a little bit Demolition Man. And it's sort of this terrible, awful future, and I'm sort of warped there in a Terminator bubble every week.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what happens here. I'm never told.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Arbiter Tanner, welcome.
Hello, Jack. Who's your guest?
This is Matthew. Please meet Arbiter Tanner. He's from the distant future. It's a terrible dystopia there.
I like your cyborg eye, though. That looks pretty cool.
Oh, thank you. It's actually cosmetic, mostly. It doesn't do a lot. It just sort of makes my vision in my right eye red.
Right, like the glowing red. I like the glowing part.
Yeah, it sucks. I'm technically not allowed to drive. Anyway, I'm here from the future. I used to shoot people's dicks off if I disagreed with their reviews.
They're rotten. He's here to arbitrate.
Films. Yeah, I'm Arbiter Tanner. But we got some feedback that was a little violent for the sort of rom-com crowd. So now I dispense justice in the form of kisses. The review I agree with the most about this film.
Yeah. Well, gets receive all my kisses.
And everyone else is withheld kisses.
Yeah. And doomed forever to live in the shadows. It's our hit segment. It's called On the One Hand. And it's where I've collected a number of positive, middling, and negative reviews. And we don't look at the critics. Matthew, we're men of the people. We're not interested in what the critics have to say. They can go fuck themselves. We're interested in authenticity, just like the 90s children that we are. And we go to the people themselves to
the
get
full
the
spectrum.
Raw...
The people who are writing little notes on the VHS at the video store.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, God, exactly. I'm so glad I wasn't aware of that.
So we're going to begin with our segment within a segment that is also called, confusingly, On the One Hand. And it's where we talk about some positive reviews from the film. I've collected a couple. The first is from Brian M., who gave this film 5 stars on September 13th, 2013, and says... Miss being single.
Huh. Oh.
Well.
Poor guy. Brian, it sounds like you're in a toxic relationship. Get out of there, man.
There's that point early in the movie where, like, the Campbell Scott character is like,
my dad left home when I was 8, and all he said to me, have fun. Stay single. I was 8.
Oh, yeah.
So, like, this guy was like, no, but his father's a jackass. I so badly wish I never married this woman.
I don't think you can publicly say miss being single, because by definition, it means that your partner...
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think people are...
Is onerous to you.
Online, especially in the IMDb reviews, or Rotten Tomato reviews.
God, imagine, like, you know, finding that your partner or whatever, like, and you happen to... happen upon it one way or another, and you're like, wait, what?
Just shitting all over you in the Rotten Tomato reviews.
Like, this is how I find out? We've been together for 7 years.
Brian M. is like, I've been getting away with this since 2013, but some fucking jackass put it on a podcast and now I'm divorced.
We do. There is a whole, like, there is a narrative that we've noticed throughout the Rotten Tomato reviews.
Yeah.
We've been doing this long enough now that there's some recurring characters, certainly.
Yeah.
And then some rivalries, it seems like, and some definite religious nuts.
Yeah, I haven't found any religious nuts this time, but there are a surprising number of religious nuts on the on the Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. I sympathize with Brian M.
Yeah. Okay.
But I'm not sure he's earned my kisses yet.
Isabel Marufo gave this film 5 stars on November 15th, 2009, with the following review. The noise is far too rad.
The what?
The noise is far too rad.
Wow.
Oh, is that a quote from the movie?
No, I think she's maybe just saying that the soundtrack is cool, and maybe she's English is not her first language. I don't know, but it sounds like a very 90s way of describing
this
film.
Yeah, it sounds like she's trying to be a Ninja Turtle.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a very 90s. That's definitely what I was doing in 1992.
You were checking out the Secret of the Ooze.
I was consuming.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
This is a segment within a segment we like to call On the Fence Hand. Why do we call it that? I wanted to call it On the Fence.
Yeah, but we have two segments already, on the one hand and on the other hand. So the one that's middling reviews would certainly be On the Fence Hand.
Yeah, so Tanner's decided it's got to be called On the Fence Hand. The first middling review I collected is from Skyler, who gave this film 2.5 stars on December 11th.
John, from Breaking Bad. Okay. The wife from Breaking Bad.
The wife from Breaking Bad. Skyler says, if you're at an Alice in Chains concert in the early 90s, shut your mouth and invest every atom of your attention on Layne Staley and the band. Trust me, your relationship issues can wait until the gig is over. Fair enough.
Wow. Sounds like this guy has a lot of relationship issues.
I think that's fair enough. It's something I notice as well. It's like, shut the fuck up. They're playing wood, dude.
They don't know what they're getting, you know?
He's going to be dead within 5 years.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, no, not five. He died in 02. But
I saw Alice in Chains at Lollapalooza, and Layne Staley got really mad because people were throwing bottles at him.
God, it's real Gen X 90s energy.
I saw Journey at the Milford Oyster Festival last summer.
Who'd you see?
Journey.
Where? In the dystopian future?
Milford.
They're still around?
Milford Oyster. Yeah. Milford, Connecticut is
thriving Journey back
in the far future. Yeah, and it's been some turnover, certainly.
People just never stop believing that far in the future. Like,
everyone's saying along.
That's awesome.
Or like Vox, you know, like Vox boxed along.
Yeah, they're all holograms. Daniel G gave the film 3 stars on April 23rd, 2012, and he says, hit a nerve and it hurt.
Wow, everyone's so quippy.
But I don't know what he means.
Rotten Tomatoes reviews today.
Like, I feel like I need more context about his life. Like, what do you mean?
Who do you suppose he was relating to in this movie? Because, like, most of the main characters get kind of a happy ending. So is he relating to, like, the red-haired woman who's just being, like, tormented and eventually goes away?
Maybe he just sent off his video dating VHS.
Oh, yeah. Hit a nerve. Everyone constantly bullies me, too. Yeah.
Like, there are some very bitter guys in the video dating montage. Maybe, like, he saw too much of himself in one of those guys.
Yeah. Me, too.
Nate H., on August 7th, 2011, gave this film 2.5 stars. That's Big Nate from the comic strip Big Nate, Tanner. Is that before your time?
I don't know what you're talking about. Isn't Big Nate the name of a rapper?
Here's what Big Nate says, and I hope it's a reference to the movie, though I couldn't find it. Working on my dental dam costume for Safe Sex Party.
Oh, yeah, they have the scene where like she's at the contraceptive party. So, yeah, okay, yeah.
Okay.
I feel like that's a high bar to clear, because I'm not sure if most people recognize a dental dam, to be honest with you. Much less, like, I mean, they were like, is that a saran wrap? You know, whatever.
I think dental dam jokes is a big kind of a thing that went away with the 90s.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's sponge-worthy, you know?
It's sponge-worthy, yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, still condoms, though. You could do a condom outfit will always be recognizable.
Oh, yeah, like Howie Mandel.
Well, especially since one of these guys is a giant human penis.
I heard Howie Mandel really hurt his sinuses doing that. Rolling a condom over his head and blowing it up.
Okay. That's your fun trivia.
I guess. Yeah. I guess I should fact check it.
I'll give you one more middling review from this film. Jay Wasu gave this film 3.5 stars on July 16th, 2011, with the following review. A 3.5-star film that I give 4 stars simply because I'm a Gen Xer.
Yeah.
True, but you didn't. Jay Wasu gave it 3.5 stars. It's a fucking lie.
I can't confirm
lie.
That he's actually... I can't confirm it,
Tanner.
Okay, I'm sorry I said that.
Tanner, as
I'm
a hardcore sorry. Millennial, what's a movie that would be like that for you, where it's like, you know, this movie's kind of mid, but this is my youth.
From Justin to Kelly.
Okay.
What? From what to what?
Justin to Kelly. Kelly Clarkson, Justin Guarini, the two finalists of season 1 of American Idol, I think, as a as part of the deal
yeah.
for being the finalists of the first season of American Idol, got to do a teen comedy together called From Justin to Kelly.
Yeah, it's kind of like a throwback to like the old like Disney beach movies with like Annette Funicello kind of stuff.
It's my generation 16 Candles.
Yeah,
you know.
Okay, that's really beautiful.
And then they stopped doing that. Like they never did it again. Although I think in the second year it was Ruben Studdard and Clay Aiken. Like that would have been an interesting two-hander.
Was it called From Ruben to Clay?
Or
that
vice
sounds
versa.
Great. I'd watch.
Could
it.
Have been.
Yeah, from Clay to Ruben. Yeah, very good.
Well, it's funny because like it's from Justin to Kelly, right? So like Kelly gets second billing despite winning the show.
Yeah, that's bullshit. That's...
Didn't Justin win the show?
No, Kelly
Is
did.
Is it conceivable
famously.
That? Okay.
People are always underwriting Kelly Clarkson.
Thank goodness for that.
This is a segment within a segment that I like to call On the Other Hand. And yep. it's I'm only going to read, I've collected a number, but I'm only going to read 2 1-star reviews of this film because they're all wrong. Andre. Mm-hmm.
Are you? Oh, I didn't realize Arbiter Jack joined me.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm not allowed to comment. I'm totally unbiased here. I'm a journalist.
Okay.
Andre O, and it's like a zero. It's got like that line through it. Andre Zero. That's
pretty
fucking
cool.
Yeah. Gives this film 1 star on November 12th, 2008. Review will be written when, if rewatched. Probability, 0.
Wow. Like 0?
Like yeah. his name. Yeah.
Like his name.
Well, then why even then go back and edit yourself? Because it's not when or if.
I feel like he
you're definitely not. This is the final review.
I feel like he should have just been like, I give it 0 stars if I could. That should be his deal.
That'd
if your
be
name
cool.
is Zero.
Andre Zero. Maybe he just goes around giving 0 stars to everything.
Maybe it's Billy Corgan. He wore that 0 shirt all the time.
Famous.
That's Billy, and Billy's still fucking pissed because Drown got killed on the radio.
And he's also declaring himself 0 in that. So he's owning it.
He makes a strong point. Can you do another 1 star? I'm feeling pretty compelled by the 1 stars.
I've got one more 1 star that I'm going to read
you.
Let's
do a couple more.
I can do a few more if you want, but this is the one that I've selected. It's Sean R's 1 star review on October 28th, 2007. Here's what Sean R says. Yeah, I used to like it too, but I was wrong.
Sean Rambo.
Thank you. But I was wrong.
Sorry, Matthew, sometimes we like to guess who the reviewer is.
Yeah.
And I'm a little slow on the uptake today. It's been some tricky names.
Yeah. I'll start again.
But Sean Rambo.
Here's what Sean Rambo says. Yeah. They do never say it. Yeah. It's Sean Rambo. He says, yeah, I used to like it too, but I was wrong. Get over it.
Oh, wow. That's a very 90s attitude.
Yeah.
I liked it when it was cool.
It's sort of that like corn nuts humor, you know?
That's cool. I think that's cool. Matthew, you can weigh in as well, but Tanner is the final arbitration. Who do you think is correct here out of all these reviews?
I think the closest truth is a guy who is basically like, this is kind of an okay movie, but I have these rose-colored glasses, so it's better than I think that's like this movie is like such a prime example of that kind of thing where it's like basically just a off the rack rom-com, or at least the off the rack rom-com of this period of time. Rom-coms have very different energy now,
but it's also so cool. It's like, you know, this has been kind of a theme of our conversation, but like because this was made before any of these bands were meaningfully big outside of Seattle. Like it hits so different when it came out because all these bands were huge and it feels like a cash in attempt and like cynical and just like a rom-com that's of the moment. But in fact, it was like literally the coolest, most underground, like predicting the zeitgeist movie of all time when it was
like,
made.
When you consider like rom-coms of the past, you know, 21st century rom-coms, like none of this movie would have anything to do with that because like no one in this movie is rich. No one's going to any fantastical places, you know, it's about cool people, like genuinely cool people. No one works for a magazine, you know?
Yeah. This is sort of when they update this film with Reality Bites, they all have like either cool or corporate jobs.
Yeah.
And like that's the tension.
This one felt, we've watched a lot of these 90s rom-coms now, and this one felt like it had a different energy from all the others.
Yeah, and it's because it like the 90s hasn't like totally calcified yet.
Matthew, I really respect you. This is Arbiter Tanner again. I really respect you. It was actually a huge honor to meet you. Fluxblog is still really huge in the future, in the metaverse.
Wow.
It is the metaverse, essentially. It's sort of like has taken over the metaverse. It's pretty dangerous. But I disagree with your assessment. The correct person who's getting all my kisses is, I think the second one was her name, Sophia.
Oh, Isabel? The one who says the Isabel? Noise is far too rad?
Mm.
Okay.
And I'm going to be heading back to the future now and sending Tanner back.
Okay.
And again, please don't tell him about anything that transpires here.
Great.
I guess that phrase makes more sense in the future.
What?
What? What are you talking about?
Yeah, the noise is too far rad. Is that something they're saying in the future, Tanner? Did you notice while you were there?
Yeah, it's sort of this like incantation.
You know? Okay, cool. And it has a negative
valence. They say it like they say aloha in Hawaii. It sort of means hello and goodbye.
Okay. Yeah, that's really nice. Yeah. We are almost done here. Do you want to do Burns?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay.
I don't want to go first, though. I want to go last.
Okay. And Matthew may not be able to go because I didn't warn him in advance that we were going to be doing our hit segment.
Totally fine. Yeah,
Burn of the Week, where we talk about the burns in the movie. So maybe it's just me, but I did capture a burn. It's at the 41-minute mark when, what's her name? Bridget Fonda calls up Matt Dillon, I think, and is trying to be super sexy.
I'm on the bed right now, wearing something really outrageous. I've got no underwear on. I need to be touched. I'm burning for you, Cliff.
And then she got the wrong number. It's some dude on the other end of the phone. He goes,
I think you got the wrong number, lady, but I'll be right over.
Very 90s moment. Tanner, did you capture a burn?
No, I don't have one. I thought I could find one, but...
No, that's all right. It's kind of a burn light movie.
I'm thinking of the moment where Paul Giamatti.
A little bit of a burn light movie.
He's just like having this like hot makeout session, and then like they catch him. He makes eye contact. He's like, but he kind of gives this like what kind of face? Like how that might be it for me. It's a non-verbal burn. Like how dare you? Paul Giamatti is macking right now.
That happened to me one time, famously.
What? Tell us about it.
I went to an off-Broadway play one time and someone was loudly eating M&Ms behind me, and I politely turned around to give him an eye, and it was Paul Giamatti.
Wait, really? How come you've never told me this before? It's one of the most interesting things that's ever happened to you.
He's eating peanut M&Ms right behind me. Loudly.
Yeah, whether it's a character or him in real life, you should just never question whatever Paul Giamatti's doing.
No, I hope you
won,
didn't.
Like a awards for his portrayal as John Adams.
Okay.
Yeah. And he's great in the TV show Billions.
So everyone from this movie went on to go be in Billions?
Well, he's the main guy in Billions for sure.
I have not seen
it. No, I didn't have any burns. I guess she asks if she's an Amazonian at some point, and Steve says that she's from the High Plains.
That's another classic Matt Dillon moment where she's like, tell me honestly.
I mean, is that what you want? You know? And don't lie, because when you do, your eye twitches, and I know it anyway.
Okay. Ask me.
Are my breasts too small for you?
Sometimes.
All right, like sometimes?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sometimes. It was the 90s. Everyone was like, it's too mean.
Yeah.
They're not good burns because they're all too mean. They're too targeted.
See, if this movie was in the recent past, like Janet would be like, should I get a BBL? So like, is my butt too small for you? It's like, sometimes.
Wow. Sounds like this movie is in desperate need of a remake. And I have found three eligible.
Just the guys.
Flippers.
Yeah.
I believe that is most of the time we have for today, unless either of you have any burning things you'd like to share about the film that you have not had an opportunity to say yet. Chris Cornell's in it.
R.I.P. R.I.P.
Oh, we should probably do Salman Rushdie. No, he's not. He wasn't in it.
Oh, yeah. We should. Yeah, this is a hit segment we have called Salman Rushdie Check.
Salman Rushdie, hello.
Hi. The question is, what does truth mean?
You may or may not know that the internet is full of completely nonsensical websites.
Where we check to see if Salman Rushdie is in the movie, and yeah, no, he's not in this one.
Not in this one.
It's only, so far, he's, I think...
Only one hit.
Only one time have we had a hit with the Salman Rushdie check.
What was he in?
Yeah. Pretty big role in Bridget Jones's Diary.
Yeah, he has a surprisingly large role in Bridget Jones's Diary. That's all the time we have for today. I would like to thank you, Tanner, very much for bearing with us.
Hey, no problem.
I would like to thank Matthew very much.
Learned a lot, I would
for
say.
Bearing with us as well and for joining
Forgot
us
a lot of details of my childhood.
On the show.
Some fond childhood memories have now been supplanted by knowledge about fucking Stone Temple Pilots or whatever.
Just trains.
Matthew, where can people find you and what's the best episode that they should listen to get into Flux Pod? And it's the one with me on Just
Yeah, I think they should definitely go to the REM episode. I think that the best place to find me is actually Flux Blog on Substack. Because that's it's a free Substack. I'm not making people pay for that. But it also just kind of collects everything I do for the week. So all my blog posts, if I have a podcast, I have all these playlists that come out. They're all in one place. And that's the best place to do it. Fluxblog.substack.com.
Excellent. I would like to remind folks that they can and indeed must subscribe to our Patreon. It's patreon.com/BSCCpodcast. It's fun and it's good and it's a great way to support the show.
Yeah, we talk about the TGIF shows. We're in the winter of 1989 right now.
Yeah, we've been stuck there for a long time.
Yeah.
You can join our Facebook group. It's Baby Nation on Facebook, and you can rate and recommend the show wherever folks do that, and we appreciate people who have done it. All that remains is for me to say that this week my name has been Jack Alexander Shepard.
My name is Tanner Greenring.
And I've been Matthew Perpetua. And Jack and Tanner, you rock my world.
Janet, you rock my world.
Whoa, thank you.
Thank you. Nobody ever says that to us.
No, people should say that more often. That's now a rule. If you come on the show, you have to say that.
And finally, I hope that you find your Mudhoney Ever After.
Poor. We might be children.